Welcome to Bally Baptist Church in Ballymena for our audio Bible study on the life of Samuel, the Kingmaker. Thank you for those who have joined with us for this study over the past 19 weeks. And now we come to the last in this series on Samuel tonight. And I trust you've been challenged and blessed through the study of God's Word. It's my intention to take a wee break from the Tuesday night audio Bible study, just for a few weeks. But God willing, we'll be returning on Tuesday the 8th of September. And in September, I'll be doing a live streaming visual Bible study when I intend to finish the series that was abandoned last March when we went into lockdown because of the COVID-19. For those of you who have a good memory, you'll remember that the series was But God Meant It for Good, Studies in the Life of Joseph. And we left that study at a very critical moment in the story, Genesis 45, and Joseph was revealing to his brothers his true identity. And we saw last time, back in March, the revelation of his person, the revelation of his peace, the revelation of his plan, the revelation of his position. And God willing, we're going to take up the threads of that on the 8th of September and go on to see how this amazing story of Joseph comes to a conclusion. But that's for September. Tonight, relax, sit back, and enjoy this last message on Samuel the Kingmaker. May it be a real blessing to your heart. Now let's turn to the Word of God. And we're turning to 2 Samuel chapter 1. 2 Samuel, chapter 1, and we're reading from verse 1. 2 Samuel 1 and 1. Now it came to pass after the death of Saul, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, and David had abode 2 days in Ziklag, that it came even to pass on the third day that, behold, a man came out of the camp of Saul with his clothes rent and earth upon his head. And it was so when he came to David that he fell to the earth and did obeisance. And David said unto him, From whence cometh I? And he said unto him, Out of the camp of Israel am I escaped. And David said unto him, How went the matter? I pray thee, tell me. And he answered that the people are fled from the battle, and many of the people also are fallen and dead. And Saul and Jonathan his son are dead also. And David said unto the young man that told him, How knowest thou that Saul and Jonathan his son be dead? And the young man that told him said, As I happened by chance upon Mount Gilboa, behold, Saul leaned upon his spear, and lo, the chariots and the horsemen followed hard after him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me and called unto me, and I answered, Here am I. And he said unto me, Who art thou? And I answered him, I am an Amalekite. And he said unto me again, Stand, I pray thee, upon me and slay me, for anguish is come upon me, because my life is yet whole in me. So I stood upon him and slew him, because I was sure that he would not live after that he was fallen. And I took the crown that was upon his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and have brought them thither unto my Lord. Then David took hold of his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even, for Saul and for Jonathan his son, and for the people of the Lord, and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. And David said unto the young man that told him, Whence art thou? And he answered, I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite. And David said unto him, How wast thou not afraid to stretch forth thine hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And David called one of the young men and said, Go near and fall upon him. And he smote him that he died. And David said unto him, Thy blood be upon thy head, for thy mouth has testified against thee, saying, I have slain the Lord's anointed. And amen. God will bless too is the reading of his word.
You might have heard or seen an email that's going the rounds at the moment, and it's about how, what if we treated our Bible the way we treat our mobile phone? And I thought it was interesting, and so I put it on the overhead. Listen to this. If we treated our Bible like our phone, we would carry it around in our purses and our pockets. We would check it every hour to see what it's saying to us. We would turn the car back if we forgot it. We would use it to get messages from the text. We would feel that we could not live without it. We would give our children one as a birthday present. It would be confiscated in school for being used in class. We would use it as we travel without embarrassment. We would be glad to use it in emergencies. During the day, we probably know where our phone is and don't know where our Bible is. Our Bible will never have a faulty signal. The Bible will never be disconnected, for the bill has been paid in full already. And it does just remind how attached we are to these modern gadgets, and how if we were half as attached to our Bible, it might do us better dividends. Part of a reason for a Bible study, of course, and many churches no longer have a separate Bible study, one of our reasons is to make sure we give the Word of God that central position and we spend time to study it rather than just glossing over it. And I trust that as we have gone through these studies on Samuel, that not only was it a blessing to you, but the next time you lift these same passages to read them, some of what we have learned together will come flooding back to your mind. I have a big task of trying to finish this study tonight. So let's get into the text. I want you to see three main things tonight. And the first thing I want you to see is what I've called vindication. In the passage that we've read tonight, we find another story, another narrative of the death of Saul. In fact, there's three biblical records on the nature of Saul's death. We read one last week in 1 Samuel 31. Then we have this report from this messenger in 2 Samuel chapter 1. And then we have the official chronicle of his death, if you will, in 1 Chronicles chapter 10. And it's interesting, and I commend it to your reading, because in 1 Chronicles 10, we are told that it was in fact God that killed Saul for his rebellion, and in particular for seeking the guidance of a witch. And you'll find in 1 Chronicles 10, verses 13 and 14. And so there are three passages that deal with the death of Saul. But 2 Samuel chapter 1 is our main text tonight. And I want you to, first of all, under this heading, to see the deceitful messenger. There's no doubt that this man has been on the battlefield, and there is no doubt that he identified through the among the thousands, maybe there are hundreds anyway, that were slain on the battlefield. He identified the bodies of Saul and the sons, and he was able to take the crown and the gold armband that were particularly worn by the king and bring them to David. However, he told lies and made claims that he had taken Saul's life. Saul and his three sons were dead and lost their lives on the battlefield, but this messenger decided to embellish the story a wee bit. He probably thought that he wasn't really doing anything wrong. All he was doing was embellishing the story to give him a more prominent part in the narrative. He didn't alter the end result. Saul and his sons were still dead. They were killed in the battle. And David, no doubt, would be thrilled that Saul was now dead. His adversary was gone. And so the messenger thought it prudent to take the credit and maybe even get a reward for his diligence. His dishonesty was going to end up costing him his life. So the deceitful messenger who claimed to kill Saul and the sons when he had done no such thing. Secondly, I want you to see the grieving camp. We read it in verse number 11. Then David took hold of his clothes and rent them, and likewise all the men that were with him. And they mourned and wept and fasted until even for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of the Lord and for the house of Israel, because they were fallen by the sword. I imagine this Amalekite messenger being a bit stunned at the reaction when he broke the news of Saul's death. He was expecting elation. He was expecting a pat on the back. He was expecting a euphoria that now the enemy was gone. But instead he saw David and his men tearing their clothes and mourning the death of Saul. And slowly, for this messenger, the expected rejoicing and the possible reward evaporated from his mind. It was obvious that he didn't know the heart of David. You see, in David's eyes, Saul was never his enemy. And that is demonstrated way over in 2 Samuel 22. I put it in the overhead. Way over in chapter 22, David spake unto the Lord the words of this song in the day that the Lord had delivered him out of the hand of all his enemies and out of the hand of Saul. Now that tells me that David didn't put Saul in with his enemies. It was whenever the Lord delivered him from all his enemies and out of the hand of Saul. And on the two occasions when David had the opportunity to kill Saul, he made it very clear that he would not lift his hand or lay hands on the Lord's anointed. It's interesting that in this section, the messenger describes himself in verse 13. He says, I am the son of a stranger, an Amalekite. Now that's significant, because that term stranger is significant. It spoke of a proselyte. It spoke of a resident alien. He was an Amalekite who was living in Israel and had adopted Israel lifestyle and had adopted Israeli thinking. And so he was, his father was an Amalekite, but he was a stranger in Israel and had accepted Israeli law and Israeli standards. Adopted the culture and the lifestyle. And he falls to the ground before David in honor in verse 2. So he appears to recognize David's claim to the throne. He also is surprised at David's grief. So he was probably aware of Saul's hatred and the countrywide search that Saul had had to try and destroy David. This messenger made a very common mistake. He jumped to conclusions that seemed obvious to him, but were in fact 100% wrong. We're good at that. We sometimes jump to the conclusions that to us at the time seem absolutely obvious, only to find we had got the wrong end of the stick. My advice is, until you know the whole story, say nothing. That's a wee bit of advice. Until you know the whole story, say nothing. The deceitful messenger, the grieving camp. Thirdly, the righteous judgment. Verse 13. And David comes back at evening, and the time of mourning has ended. That fasting has ended for Saul and the sons and the people of Israel. And David interrogates the messenger once more and concludes that he deserves to die. And he sends a young man and says, go near and fall upon him. And he smote him that he died. He decided to kill him because he confessed to murdering the Lord's anointed king. And as a proselyte, he should have known that that was against the law. It seems cruel in a sense. But when you look at it, first of all, consider the Jews had been commanded to annihilate the Amalekites way back in Exodus 17. and also in Deuteronomy 25. And Saul had failed to do that and was pulled over the coals by Samuel in 1 Samuel 15 because he did not completely destroy the Amalekites. And so David was obeying the will of God whenever he said to kill the Amalekite. He was obeying the law that had been laid down previously. Secondly, in having this servant killed, David was vindicating Saul and his sons and showing publicly that he had not been Saul's enemy and he took no pleasure in his death. And it made the transition to the throne that wee bit easier. So he was also vindicating the Lord's message, authenticating it, if you will, by killing this servant. Also, it was a very brave thing to do. Don't forget that David is still living in Ziklag, which was Philistine territory. And they were friends with the Amalekites. And so taking this stand while still in Ziklag was a brave thing indeed to do. And Achish probably at this stage still thought that David was his friend and ally. And so he was brave in front of the Lord's enemy. Can I say to you, those three principles are still applicable to today. We need to obey the Lord's command. We need to live out and vindicate the Lord's message. And we need to be brave in front of the Lord's enemy. And I believe we are in a day whenever it will be increasingly difficult to take our stand for the things that we know and the things that we believe and the things that we love. And it will be difficult to stand and be counted. And that will be a test for all of us to see who will stand firm when the temperature rises. And so, vindication. Secondly, I want you to see lamentation. And this is in verse 17 through to 27. David's grief over the death of Saul and Jonathan was sincere. And to help people remember them, he wrote a touching requiem in their honor. It was called the Use or the Lament of the Bow. And he ordered that it be taught and sung in David's ancestral tribe of Judah. Let's read it together. Verse 17. And David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and over Jonathan his son. Also he bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow. Behold, it is written in the book of Jasher. The beauty of Israel is slain upon the high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet, with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. How are the mighty fallen in the midst of the battle? O Jonathan, thou wast slain in thine high places. I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant hast thou been unto me. Thy love to me was wonderful, passing the love of woman. How are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? This lovely lamentation, a dirge, if you will, and you find it from 19 to 27. It's interesting, in this song, It says nothing of the deceased's sins or of their mistakes or of the fact that he had tried to kill David many's a time with a javelin. All those things at a time of bereavement are laid aside, and rather it celebrates their skill and their bravery and their willingness to die for their country. People deal with bereavement in different ways. David's way was to write a song. Some people are shattered while others are stoic. Some bottle up emotion while others vent their frustrations very vocally. And sometimes as a pastor, you're in the firing line for that. And you have to remember that they're not really taking it out on you, but there's a frustration and they have to shout at somebody and they don't want to shout at the family. And so a pastor is in the firing line at times. And it's good to be that one that they can shout at and take that frustration and help them through those difficult times. In ministering to homes of bereavement, I found that presence and love and support are far more significant than a well thought out message or attempting to give an explanation. For those in the darkness of bereavement, I offer my advice for what it's worth. And of course, it's only the scratching the surface, but first of all, allow yourself to grieve. Allow yourself to grieve. It's a natural, God-designed process. And so many times people try to have that stiff upper lip and not show any emotion. And we have to say, allow yourself to grieve. It's part of the healing process. Also, could I advise that you accept help? Sometimes people try to get close and they get pushed away. And you try to manage on your own and you try to manage to stick through it yourself. Accept help. Thirdly, be patient. It takes time. Especially when you have known someone or maybe a family member's been there for a long time. It takes a long time to get over that. In fact, in some ways, you never get over it. And so you need to be patient. Could I say it's not unusual to have vivid dreams after a bereavement? Because the things, the person, the memories are very fresh in your mind. And so it's important that you understand that those vivid dreams are perfectly natural and understandable. And even, if I dare say it, sensing the presence of someone that's deceased. We have found it so often where people have said that they felt that the person was there. They felt their presence. And that's all part of missing someone and longing that someone was there. Be prepared to share treasured memories. And that sometimes helps. Avoid making major decisions immediately after a loss. Better letting things settle just when your mind's clearer, when your mind's more focused, and not making major decisions at a time of loss. And also, have somebody that you can be absolutely honest with. Very important. Somebody that you can be yourself with. Not put on a front, but have a confidant. Somebody that you can talk to. Just for your interest, this dirge of David's for Saul and his sons comes in five stanzas. And here's the five stanzas. You'll get it in your handout and you can look at it when you go home. First of all, he addresses the people of Israel. Verse 19, the beauty of Israel is slain upon thy high places. How are the mighty fallen? Tell it not in Gath, publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. Lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, let the daughters of the uncircumcised triumph. David calls Saul and his army the beauty and the glory of Israel. It's not a lovely term for an army. The beauty, the glory of Israel. In the narrative, we sometimes forget that Saul was a great warrior and had slain his thousands. And we read that in 1 Samuel 18 and 1 Samuel 14, I think it is, where Saul had slain his thousands. In verse 20, David urges the people not to spread the bad news of Israel's defeat. Publish it not in the streets of Ascalon. Tell it not in Gath. Don't spread the bad news. The Philistines will spread it. Everybody will hear of it. Let them spread the bad news. Don't you be doing it. And this verse has been used over the years by preachers to try and stop negative talk about problems within a fellowship or an assembly being gossiped about and spread outside. Publish it not. Tell it not in Gath. Keep it within the assembly. Keep it within the fellowship. Gossip is a plague, especially among God's people. Of course, we have the good sense always to add a wee bit. We'll say, now don't say, but. Or we'll say, well, I heard. Or just for your prayer, I thought you should know. We live in a culture that loves people's dirty laundry. Hearsay and rumors are the foodstuff of many of us. And when we're talking about a situation with someone who is neither part of the problem nor part of the solution, the chances are we're maybe gossiping. And I think we all, and I'm speaking to my own heart, we need to learn those lessons. Please don't do the devil's work for him. Some just love the power and the importance of knowing something that others don't know and being the center of attention while telling it. So he addresses the people of Israel. Then he addresses the mountains of Gilboa, verse 21. Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you, nor fields of offerings, for there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul, as though he had not been anointed with oil. And he addressed the mountains where Saul was lost in battle with the Philistines, indeed lost his life. And David prays that God would forsake that place, that God's creation would join him in mourning the defeat of Israel and the fall of the king. And so he calls on Gilboa. And then verses 22 and 23, he praises Saul and Jonathan. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, the sword of Saul returned not empty. Saul and Jonathan were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. And this is the core, the heart of the song, depicting Saul and Jonathan as mighty warriors. Jonathan's arrows hit their target. Saul's sword did not return empty. Very graphic kind of language. Swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. Ever since the consultation with the witch at Endor, before the battle, Saul knew that he and his sons would die in the battle. Yet, he proceeded. He was brave and courageous. Jonathan knew his father had disobeyed God and sinned against David, yet he stayed at his father's side until he died. I tell you, we could see much that would speak of the courage and the bravery of not only Saul, but his sons, and indeed his armor bearer. In the next section, verse 24, he addresses the daughters of Jerusalem. Ye daughters of Israel, weep over Saul, who clothed you in scarlet with other delights, who put on ornaments of gold upon your apparel. And we learn in that in spite of Saul's faults and failures, during his reign, Saul had brought stability to the nation. The various nomadic tribes had abandoned their selfish independence and their competition with one another, and had come under the umbrella of Saul and Israel, and were striving to work together to better their lot, including the economic position of the nation. And Saul spearheaded victories over nations, enemies, which not only brought financial betterment, but also safer villages and towns and farmland. And here in this song, David reminds the ladies that it was Saul that brought them their style and their finery. Ladies, just you remember that Saul it was that gave us the stability so that you could afford to go out and buy your clothes and buy your... And he praises Saul for his economic handling of the nation. And then finally, he speaks about his beloved friend, Jonathan. Jonathan, my brother. That has a double meaning, of course, because they were brothers-in-law. David was married to Michal, Jonathan's sister. But they were also brothers in heart and brothers in spirit. And they were covenanted together. This lament accomplishes a few things. First of all, it strengthens people's concept of the monarchy by not repeating the negative side of Saul's reign. It secondly showed that David held no grudges against his father-in-law. And it also sets an example for all of us. Whenever there is bereavement, to give that loving tribute and somehow you don't say that they were sinless, but you overlook the faults that we all have. And you overlook some of the mistakes. And you give a tribute of the good things that they did. And it gives us an example, maybe, to pay loving tribute to those who die in battle to protect our country. And there is a place in Scripture for honoring those that are fallen on behalf of their country, in duty of the nation. And so we have our remembrance services and we remember those who have paid that ultimate price for the freedom that we enjoy. Vindication, lamentation, but then thirdly, coronation. And we're into chapter 2 of 2 Samuel. Let's read verses 1 to 4. Chapter 2 of 2 Samuel. And it came to pass after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said unto him, go up. And David said, whither shall I go up? And he said, unto Hebron. So David went up thither and his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail, Nabal's wife, the Carmelite. And his men that were with him did David bring up every man with his household, and they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying that the men of Jabesh Gilead were they that buried Saul. And so we find the coronation, at least at this stage in part. David was now finally Israel's lawful king, and so had to leave the enemy territory of Ziklag. It is possible that Achish still thought David was under his authority and protection, but those days were well and truly over. David's journey had not been an easy one since shepherding his father's sheep back at Bethlehem. Killing the lion and the bear had helped prepare him to kill the giant Goliath of Gath. David soothed Saul's mind with his music. He befriended Jonathan and made an enemy of Saul. For 10 years, he had been in exile in the wilderness of Judah. All the time, learning how to trust God more and more. Maybe many times he thought that time was wasted time. But no, it was beneficial and made him the man of God that he proved to be. But even now with Saul dead, it was not a case of the king is dead, long live the king. And it was not just an easy transition. There was still a lengthy wait of political intrigue and diplomatic negotiations. And you will read of those in the next 3 or 4 chapters of 2 Samuel. I want to finish the series by summarizing it into three, if I can. First of all, I want you to see a conflict. David moves to Hebron. It was a significant city in Judah. It was near the tomb of Abraham, near the tomb of Isaac and Jacob. It was a key place. For the first time in 10 years, David and his men were not fugitives. And shortly after coming to Hebron, David is recognized by the elders of Judah and is anointed king. At 30 years of age, and he would reign in Hebron for 7.5 years, according to 2 Samuel 2 and verse 11. It's a picture of harmony, if you will. David is the king, at least of Judah, and Saul has died. However, other characters now come on to the main stage. Let me suggest to you that there are four. You have David's nephews, Joab, who was David's army commander, and Azahel was also a nephew. And then there was Saul's cousin, Abner, who was Saul's army commander, and also a son of Saul who was not killed in the battle, called Ish-bosheth. And here's the four characters who take up these next chapters. Joab, Asahel, David's nephews, Saul's cousin Abner, and Saul's son Ish-bosheth. Abner was Saul's cousin, as I said, his army commander. Whenever Saul died, you would have thought that him being the army commander would have died in the battle. But he was shrewd enough to stay out of the main front of the battle, and he did not fall on his sword, but rather found himself jobless because David already had his nephew as his army commander, so he didn't need another army commander. But Abner was a smart fellow, he thought. And he thought, how can I keep myself in a job? And so he decided he would do it by making Ish-bosheth the king in Saul's place. In a sense, he was next in line to the throne. And so for a period in Judah, you have David the king. And according to Abner, Ish-bosheth is the king. And he was a weak, insipid, frail kind of a man, easily manipulated by Abner. The next thing that happens is significant. Abner kills Asahel. And if you read it, and we'll read it now just so you see it, I don't think Abner wanted to kill him. But it seemed that Asahel was gunning for him and was trying to put him into a position where he could kill him, maybe take his job, we don't know. But Abner ends up killing him. Let's read it. Verse 18 of chapter 2. And there were three sons of Zeruiah, there Joab and Abishai and Asahel. And Asahel was as light of foot as a wild roe. And Asahel pursued after Abner. And in going, he turned not to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. He had it in for Abner, didn't he? Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Art thou Asahel?" And he said, answered, "I am." And Abner said to him, "Turn thee aside to thy right hand or to thy left, and lay thee hold on one of the young men and take thee his armor." But Asahel would not turn aside from following of him. And Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn thee aside from following me. Wherefore should I smite thee to the ground? How then should I hold up my face to Joab thy brother?" Howbeit he refused to turn aside, wherefore Abner with the hinder end of the spear smote him under the fifth rib, that the spear came out behind him, and he fell down there and died in the same place. And it came to pass that as many as came to the place where Asahel fell down and died stood still. You see what I mean? It seems as if Abner, at every chance, says, "Will I tell you, you go to the right or the left. I don't want to hurt you, son. I don't want to cause any trouble. I'm going to have to face your brother." But in the end, whether to defend himself, he kills Asahel. So we have a conflict. Secondly, we have a conversion. And we are in 2 Samuel chapter 3, verse 6. And you can read about it. My time is going. Abner defects. He realizes that Ishbosheth is too weak. He's too insipid. And he realizes that he's never going to make the king of a kingdom. So he defects to David. His basic principle was always join the winning side. That was Abner's philosophy. He could see a throne of Ishbosheth would have no future, so he switched loyalties like any self-preserving, pragmatic general might do. And Abner starts what we would call today shuttle diplomacy. You can read about it when you go home. Verse 12, Abner offers to bring all Israel under David's rule. Look at verse 12. And Abner sent messengers to David on his behalf, saying, Whose is the land? Oh, saying also, make thy league with me, and behold, my hand shall be with thee to bring about all Israel unto thee. He offers David the kingdom if they can work together. And then we find that David says, well, I'll talk to you if you bring Michal, my first wife, to me. Verse 13. And he said, well, I will make a league with thee, but one thing I require of thee, that is that thou shalt not see my face, except thou first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when thou comest to see my face. David sent a messenger to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, deliver me my wife Michal, which I espouse to me for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, even from Phatiel, the son of Laish. And so we find he looks for Michal. Verse 17, Abner confers with the elders of Israel. And Abner had communication with the elders of Israel, saying, he sought for David in times past to be king over you. Now then, do it. Boy, I've preached on that many times. You sought for David in times past to be king over you. That was the longing of your heart. That's what you wanted. Now then, do something about it. Do it. And many a time I've challenged in a gospel meeting. You know what you need to do. You've heard the gospel. You know the truth. You've been steeped in it. Now then, do it. Do it. Do it. Do it. And there's where it comes from. He's talking to the elders of Israel and saying, you wanted David to be king. Now then, here's your chance. Do it. Verse 19, he's talking to the elders of Benjamin. And Abner also spake in the ears of Benjamin. And Abner also spake in the ears of David and Hebron. All that seemed good to Israel and all seemed good to the whole house of Benjamin. And verse 21, if you drop your eye, you find that David and Abner agree on how to transfer the kingdom. And Abner said to David, verse 21, I will arise and go and will gather all Israel unto my lord the king, that they may make a league with thee, and thou mayest reign over all that thine heart desireth. And David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. And it looks as if there's going to be a simple transition of power. But Joab heard about it. And Joab decided to kill Abner in revenge for him killing Asahel, his brother. And we find that in verse 22. Let me read it to you. And behold, the servants of David and Joab came from pursuing a troop and brought in a great spoil with them. But Abner was not with David in Hebron, for he had sent him away and he was gone in peace. When Joab and all the hosts that were with him were come, they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he's gone in peace. Then Joab came to the king and said, what hast thou done? Behold, Abner came unto thee. Why is it that thou hast sent him away, and he is quite gone? Thou knowest Abner, the son of Ner, when he came to thee, deceiveth thee, and to know thy going out and thy coming in, and to know all that thou doest. And when Joab was come out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, which brought him again from the well of Seir. But David knew it not. And when Abner was returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the gate to speak with him quietly, and smote him there under the fifth rib that he died, for the blood of Asahel his brother. And so Abner is killed by Joab. We have a conflict, we have a conversion, we have a coronation. And for that you really need to go to chapter 5. And those verses. Verse 1, the nation is assembled at Hebron. Then came all the tribes of David, of Israel, to David unto Hebron, and spake, saying, Behold, we are thy bone and thy flesh. Also in times past, when Saul was king over us, thou wast he that leddest out and broughtest in Israel. And the Lord said unto thee, Thou shalt feed my people Israel, and thou shalt be captain over Israel. So all the elders of Israel came to David in Hebron, and King David made a league with them in Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. And so he finds himself king over the nation. When he was a teenager, Samuel anointed him privately. Do you remember in Bethlehem when he came in from the field? He was anointed privately. Then, when he was 30 years of age, the elders of Judah anointed him restrictedly. It was just for Judah. He was 30 years of age at that stage. He served, he reigned in Judah for 7.5 years. So he's 37.5 at this point when he is proclaimed king nationally. David's not a novice anymore. He's a seasoned warrior and a gifted leader who knew the anointing of God upon his life and ministry. And at long last, the nation and the people had a king who was not only God's choice, but the people's choice. I'll leave this with you. Four of the things that he did in his reign. He established a new capital city, which was Jerusalem, and is the capital to this day. He also established political alliances, which would prove vital for the well-being of the nation and provide stability. He also defeated the Philistines, verses 17 to 25, and he relocated the Ark of the Covenant in chapter 6. And when David's day was over, such was his legacy that all the kings of Israel were measured against the standard of David. David was the king in the glory days of Israel's advancing. And ever since, they compared it to the days of David, the throne of David. He unified the nation. His legacy was a long and rich one. God chose him to establish the dynasty that would eventually bring Jesus Christ, our Savior, into the world. He was of the family of David. He extended the borders of their nation. He provided much of the wealth that was used to build the temple. He produced the king who would build the temple, Solomon. David received the plans of the temple from God. He recruited the workers to build it. David wrote songs for the Levites to sing as they worshiped God. He organized the temple ministry and taught the people of Israel that to worship God was their number one priority. David was the king that everyone else was measured by. And as Saul looked on from glory, I think he smiled, because he was Samuel, the kingmaker. and through his hands, they had gone from a people who were not a people to a disaster of a kingship with Saul in many ways. And David, who brought them to the pinnacle of glory days under his reign. Samuel, the kingmaker. May God bless his word to our hearts.